Jay Powell had a press conference today. We listened, so you don't have to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, May the 1st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, we take you now to the Federal Reserve Building in Washington, D.C. Fed Chair Jay Powell at the mic. The state of the American economy in 25 seconds.
You know, I think all I can see is that we have an economy where the expansion is continuing. Growth is at a healthy level. The labor market is strong. We see job creation. We see wages moving up. Inflation is low, which gives us the ability to be patient, and we do expect it to move up, and we want it to move up to 2%. So I see us on a good path for this year.
Chair Powell and the gang at the Federal Open Market Committee wrapped up a two-day meeting today. Macroeconomic policy and interest rates, of course, on the agenda. Macro economy we just gave you. Interest rates. Well, Mr. Powell was relentlessly neutral, refused every opportunity to give a hint about where he thought rates were going, either up or down. The word of the day actually wasn't rates or patient, a word he is often fond of saying, Jay Powell. Inflation was the word cloud winner today, 45 times in a 45-minute press conference. Yes, we counted, because as we told you earlier this week, ain't nobody can really figure out why inflation is so low right now with the economy and the job market doing so well. Still, Powell is pretty neutral about it.
We say in our statement of longer-run goals and monetary policy strategy that the committee would be concerned if inflation were running persistently above or below 2%. So persistent carries the sense of something that's not transient, something that will sustain over a period of time.
I love the way he gives vocabulary lessons, right? In other words, inflation is bouncing around a little bit, Chair Powell said, but the Fed is good with that. On the maybe not so great front, trade.
I think one thing would be that the resolution of the uncertainty around these trade negotiations would, I would guess, be a positive for business sentiment.
Just not right away.
Most of the gains, though, I would expect, from a successful trade negotiation, would come in over time. You know, they wouldn't be the kind of thing where you'd immediately feel big effects right away, but they could be quite important over a longer period.
Chair Powell said he is counting on businesses and consumers to keep driving the economy. So we're here with another opportunity for us to consume. Instagram is getting deeper into the business of selling us stuff. The photo sharing app owned, as you know, by Facebook is already full of influencers. Exhibit A, the Kardashians, that is people with huge followings who post about products they use or get paid to use. But now Instagram is going to make it possible for users to buy those self-same products from influencers right inside the app. No linking out to separate websites. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino finds out what makes us Insta-buy.
Ed Carroll likes to think he's immune to digital advertising, but he loves Instagram. That's where he sees his buddy's vacations and checks out all the cute doggos. And that's how they get him.
I have a chihuahua, and I bought like a vest for her, and then I've also bought her a jacket.
Plus some t-shirts for her human owners.
One says the Chihuahua Avengers, which is the Avengers imagined as chihuahuas.
Some were advertised to him in his feed, others recommended by Instagram accounts he follows. He might have actually bought more, but he says it can be cumbersome to go through the purchasing process in the little browser on his phone. That's why integrating sales into the Instagram app could be a game changer, says Ravi Dhar, a behavioral psychologist and marketing professor at Yale.
If you reduce friction in small ways, it can have a big impact.
He says Instagram is already a space that's conducive to impulse buying. Because it's not primarily a shopping destination, people have their guard down and they can be easily convinced. Plus, Instagram is increasingly where potential consumers like to be, says May Karwowski, who runs a marketing firm specializing in influencers.
You look at how, quite frankly, toxic Twitter is, all of the debates happening on Facebook. And then Instagram is very much about creating, little happy moments.
But the very fact that Instagram is so good at making us want to buy stuff could someday drive people like Ed Carroll away.
It would probably turn me off. I wouldn't use it as much.
I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
So it was all about consumer behavior, that story from Megan was, right? Well, here's another one about how what consumers do affects how they buy. Corporate merger division. The publisher McGraw-Hill says it is going to spend $5 billion to buy Cengage. That's another big textbook publisher. It would create the second biggest textbook provider in the country. The deal would a deal getting done because consumers of textbooks, students, of course, have been giving that dusty old textbook business a run for its money. Marketplace Justin Ho is on that one.
Textbook prices have skyrocketed over the last 20 years, but lately that's starting to change, says Alex Neal at campusbooks.com, a comparison shopping site for textbooks.
So prices actually had decreased for the first time in living memory.
That's because the demand for textbooks is falling. Students are renting books or buying used books online, even borrowing them from friends. As a result, Rachel Fishman at the nonpartisan think tank New America says publishers have come up with a few tricks of their own.
Publishers have gotten really smart in creating digital systems that students have no choice but to buy into and that they can't escape.
Digital textbooks with subscription fees, online homework, and course codes that can't be resold. Frederick Mishkin is a professor at the Columbia Business School and the author of over 20 economics textbooks. He's working on his first digital-only textbook right now.
And that's the future of the industry if they can get it right.
Mishkin says digital books can benefit students if they're geared at adding to the learning experience.
Every time the student's reading something, you're giving them some feedback. You're making them actually do some little exercise so that they actually are reading more carefully.
McGraw-Hill and Cengage say they plan to expand digital offerings if the merger goes through. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders got a bit snitty. Into the close, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know how we've been talking a lot about companies going public this year, listing their shares on exchanges for sale to would-be investors? Most of the high-profile IPOs so far have been in tech. Pinterest, Lyft, Uber's coming pretty soon. There is an IPO coming, though, that is decidedly not high-tech, but very definitely cutting-edge. Beyond Meat, the California-based company that sells plant-based substitutes for beef and pork, is expected to start trading on the NASDAQ tomorrow. Ticker symbol BYND, by the way, Beyond. The main ingredient in their Beyond Burger? Protein, extracted from the humble split pea. And these days, pea protein is showing up more and more in our foods, from energy bars to cereals. It's a substitute for meat and milk, even wheat. As Marketplace's Renata Sago reports, peas are having a moment.
In a residential area of St. Paul, Minnesota, just a couple of miles from the Mississippi River, you'll find the Mississippi Market Co-op. It's a natural food store that's got refrigerated probiotics, artisan cheeses, essential oils, and a lot of pea protein.
This is kind of our alternative pasta aisle here.
Chuck Showalter is a buyer at this Mississippi market, one of three in St. Paul.
Typically here, this pasta is usually pea flour based, and it's out of stock because it's sold so well.
We stroll past a dairy section stocked with bottles of Ripple, a drink branded as nutritious pea milk. Then Showalter shows me that even the cat food here is made with peas.
Ingredients are listed by percentage: chicken liver, dried egg product, and then dried peas.
Turns out these little legumes, both yellow and green, are a good solution for consumers who want to avoid meat, lactose, even gluten. The market is still pretty small compared to, say, soybeans, but the trend is clear. Production of soybeans is declining. Peas are rising. Some analysts predict the pea protein market will at least triple in size to more than $300 million in the next few years. Ryan Claussen is running his hands through a ginormous bag of pea seeds. He farms in Belgrade, Minnesota, about 2 hours northwest of St. Paul. Claussen has 48,000 pounds of yellow field pea seeds stacked up in a shed, and he's eager to get them into the ground as soon as his soil dries out a little.
I would like to say that I go home and watch TV, but I actually go home and watch the Weather Channel.
Claussen buys his seeds from Minnesota-based Purus, the largest pea protein producer in the U.S. Once he gets them in the ground,
a week later, they emerge. And 2 weeks later, it's completely green already. That fast. It goes that quick.
He He expects to be able to harvest by late June or July. He'll sell his crop back to Purus for processing. Agribusiness conglomerate Cargill is an investor in Purus. Together, they're developing new products with pea protein. Matthew Jacobs manages Cargill's plant-based protein business.
We tried an ice cream, so just a vanilla ice cream, and really smooth texture. Let's see, we had a cheese sauce. We had a smoothie.
Jacob says peas could one day rival soybeans as a main source of plant protein. For one thing, he says, the pea is highly versatile.
The fact that it can be used well across a really wide range of very mainstream food and beverages is important.
A recent survey from the research firm Nielsen found 4 in 10 Americans are actively trying to eat more plant-based foods. Several agribusiness giants are now opening new pea processing plants to meet rising demand. They're also working to further develop other plant-based proteins, like from oats and canola. But for now, it's about the peas. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
There seemed to be some bipartisan, I wouldn't call it love, wouldn't call it spirit, I might call it pragmatism coming out of Washington yesterday, the White House meeting on infrastructure, to be specific. There was broad agreement that Congress and the president are going to have to do something about roads and bridges and all the rest. Footnote here that there wasn't any real talk about where the money is going to come from, but there is similar bipartisan pragmatism in the air about the possibility of another big move by Congress and the White House, legislation to lower prescription drug prices. That one's going to come down to money, too. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, that has the Washington influence machine running full steam.
This battle has gotten so big, it's getting tough to tune it out, especially if you watch TV.
They're America's biopharmaceutical researchers, pursuing life-changing cures in a country that fosters innovation.
The big drug companies don't see us as people. They see us as profits.
That first ad is sponsored by Pharma, which represents the multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical industry. The second is from AARP. Both ads are part of what's become a daily barrage of messaging aimed at swaying consumers and others in the high-stakes battle over drug price legislation. David Certner is a lawyer and lobbyist for AARP.
We know our members take on average between 4 and 5 prescriptions a month. So this is obviously a big deal for them personally and for most seniors.
AARP alone has 38 million members who are 50 and older. They're part of a group that tends to vote more and make more political donations than any other group. Certner says mobilizing that group is just part of the strategy.
We're targeting members of Congress and the elected officials here who are going to be the decision makers.
AARP spent over $8 million lobbying Congress last year, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Pharma spent $28 million. The drug industry has a lot on the line and a big image problem.
I hate to say it, but of course I think that the pharmaceutical companies are benefiting from this.
Karen Cox lives in New York and is what you could call an engaged healthcare consumer. Her daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when she was 9. Cox says a decade ago, her out-of-pocket cost for a 3-month supply of insulin was $300 before she hit her deductible. Today, she says,
those 3 vials of insulin are $600.
Cox doesn't just blame the drug companies. She says there are others pushing up prices. Middlemen, echoing Pharma's own wide-reaching ad campaign called Let's Talk About Cost, a.k.a. Let's Talk About Who Else Is to Blame for High Drug Costs.
More than one-third of the list price of a medicine is rebated back to middlemen, like insurers and pharmacy benefit managers.
Middlemen like PBMs and insurers have been shifting more of the cost of healthcare to you for years.
Well, there is plenty of blame to go around.
Robin Feldman is a law professor at the University of California, Hastings, and author of Drugs, Money, and Secret Handshakes.
Everybody wants to point to someone else as the bad guy, but to be fair, each of the parties is contributing to what is driving the prices up.
Because, Feldman says, at every step in the process, one of those parties takes a profit. Profits millions of potential voters say come at too high a cost.
People are hurting and they are letting their interest groups and their politicians know how they feel about it.
Those politicians have unleashed a slew of proposals for how to bring down drug prices. Proposals, but no agreement on what should be done. Only that something has to be done. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
People ask me if I want to retire. I don't want to retire. Why would I retire? I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
Not everybody feels that way. But first, let's do the numbers. Things were fine on Wall Street today until they weren't. The Dow Industrials off 162 points at the bell, 0.6%, 26,430. The NASDAQ shed 45 points, that's about a 0.5%, 8,049. The S&P 500 down 22 points, 0.7%, 29.23. CVS shot up 5.4% today. The pharmacy chain and benefits manager posted first quarter earnings that handily beat expectations. Walgreens Boots Alliance stepped up 0.2%. Rite Aid gave back about 3% today. Advanced Micro Devices weakened 2.9%, though it posted better than expected first quarter revenue and profit. The chipmaker did. Micron Technologies softened 0.3% today. Wynn Resorts rolled up 1.1%. The Massachusetts Gaming Commission is letting the casino operator keep its license for a new casino near Boston. That even after investigating the firm's handling of complaints against founder Steve Wynn. Las Vegas Sands up 1.2% today. Bond prices up just a touch. Yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.50%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Those of you waiting patiently for the next A-list government economic indicator, go ahead and set your alarms for 8:30 Friday morning Washington time. The April unemployment report will be upon us. The good people at the Labor Department will tell us how many jobs were added or lost last month. Best guesses are about 180,000 to the upside, by the way. There is going to be a whole lot of other data in there as well. Wages, industries that are growing or not. Not going to get a mention at all, though, are America's farmers and its farm workers. Marketplace Mitchell Hartman explains why what we look at are non-farm payrolls.
Let's go back to 1862. The Department of Agriculture was founded, and farm work, mostly on family farms, was a really big deal, says Notre Dame economic historian Thomas Stapleford.
Abraham Lincoln called it the People's Department because over half of all Americans at that point lived on farms.
But that was already changing. More of the work was getting done by machines. And another kind of labor was rising, factory work in cities, in dangerous conditions.
There's all this, you know, labor conflict and violence and a sense that we need to understand this phenomenon. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics was formed.
That was in 1884. BLS used systems like unemployment insurance to count this new growing workforce, systems that didn't include farm workers. Over the next century, the percentage of Americans doing farm work dwindled to the low single digits. Former Labor Department chief economist Betsy Stevenson says these days farm worker data is kind of irrelevant.
It's such a small share now that it's almost rounding error whether we put them in.
Farm workers are counted by the Department of Agriculture. Dan Sumner at UC Davis follows those numbers. He says there's a lot of labor force uncertainty right now.
As the economy's picked up in construction and other areas, fewer and fewer people are willing to do farm work. It's hard work, relatively low wages. There's more mechanization to make the workers more productive.
USDA says 784,000 workers were employed on farms as of last November. That's about one half of 1% of all U.S. workers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
How you're going to feel about this next story depends a whole lot on how you think about your job or jobs. By way of introduction, I'm obliged to mention that the Bureau of Labor Statistics says it classifies older workers as anybody 55 and up. So there's that. Also, though, ticking even higher on the age scale, the BLS says that by 2026, that is 7 short years from now, almost a quarter of the people 65 years and older in this economy are still going to be working. And not all of them are going to want to be. David Wagner from KPCC here in Los Angeles introduces us to a couple of seniors still on the job.
71-year-old Emma Allen answers the phone at the front desk of a senior center in South Los Angeles.
Good morning, People Coordinator Services. This is Emma. How may I direct your call?
She has the kind of smile she needs to be a good receptionist.
I'm the first one that they see when they come in the door, and whatever they need help with, I know where to direct them to.
Allen is here as part of a job training program for low-income seniors through the city of L.A. But her time in this program is almost over. She'll need to find a new job because, like around 30% of Americans 65 and older, she has no savings. Her nest egg was eaten up by medical bills toward the end of her husband's life. Social Security isn't enough to live on. And if she doesn't find a job, she'll have to move in with her kids.
That's it. I don't have a choice. I need the income.
Allen has documented her extensive job search in a thick manila folder. Every place she's applied to has its own entry.
I went to JCPenney, I went to Big Lots, I went to Greens Cleaner.
No one has ever outright told her she's too old for a job, but Allen thinks that's one reason why she's not getting hired.
I could feel it, you could tell. I guess they figure I can't keep up or whatever.
Looking at all these places that you've applied, looking at all this paperwork, how does it make you feel?
Tired. Tired because out of all this, somewhere there should have been something. I'm running out of places.
Seniors who need jobs the most often have the hardest time finding and keeping them.
There's a total class difference.
Nari Reed directs the Retirement Security Program at the UC Berkeley Labor Center.
For low-wage workers, you pretty much hit a wall.
Age discrimination and the physical demands of blue-collar jobs can force lower-income workers into retirement before they're ready.
The people who are working well into their late 60s and possibly into their early 70s tend to be in professional jobs.
That's the story with USC gerontology professor George Shannon, who is 79.
I did want to go over the syllabus one more time since it's
academia
half-time.
Is a relatively new career for Shannon.
Would you like to be my date tonight at a black tie dinner?
Back in 1990, he appeared on NBC's daytime soap opera Generations. But by the time he was in his 50s, he wanted to make a change.
When you get to be 45, 55, and you look at your life and you say, what have I done that's meaningful? You know, I've done a lot of commercials, I've done a lot of soaps and a few films. Is that what it's all about? Is that what I wanted to do? No, I wanted to do more.
So Shannon went back to school as a 55-year-old undergrad. He stayed to get his PhD. He says becoming a professor has kept him mentally sharp and socially engaged. It also provides a sense of purpose.
And who the hell wants to retire? People ask me if I want to retire. I don't want to retire. Why would I retire? I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
Emma Allen also gets something more than a paycheck from her work.
It's a part of making me feel that I'm worth something. I'm contributing something. I'm not just sitting on my hands waiting for somebody to give me something.
She hopes that somewhere down the line, somebody might see that. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner for Marketplace.
David's story came to us as part of the California Dream Project. That's a statewide media collaboration out here. The This final note on the way out today, which I am just going to put out there and y'all can interpret: Hulu, which, as you heard in the mid-show credit, is an underwriter of this program, had its upfront today. Those are the big to-dos in New York, where originally the broadcast networks, but now streaming platforms as well, show off their wares. Anyway, from Hulu, a couple of statistics. 80% of Hulu viewing takes place in the living room. The average Hulu customer watches across three devices. 40% of Hulu viewers binge more than one series each month, which parenthetically seems like a lot. But also, there was this. In 2018, nearly 1 million hours of Bob Ross's The Joy of Painting were watched by Hulu customers. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 162 today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ down 45 points. That's about 0.5%. S&P 500 lost 22.7%. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostet, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.